Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, USA, with me, Al Murray, John McManus and James Holland. Our last meeting, I think, before the Christmas break. Obviously, do you have turkey on Christmas Day? Because you do turkey on Thanksgiving, don't you?
Here, yeah, I mean, some people do turkey. A lot of people do, you know, prime rib or ham or, you know, there's a lot of different possibilities. It's not like, you know, turkey exclusive the way Thanksgiving tends to be.
Right. Yeah.
But,
okay.
You know, we stuff our faces one way or the other. Not too much. How about you guys?
We're having a goose. I'm cooking
a goose.
Goose.
That makes sense. Very Dickens-like, almost. Right?
Yeah. So, absolutely.
Yes,
yeah.
I think turkey is an American import, isn't it? I mean.
Yeah.
Well, necessarily, yeah.
You know, yeah, but I mean, my point is that it used to be, you know, the Christmas meal was a goose, wasn't it? And then it suddenly sort of changed at the turn of the 20th century, I think.
But. This isn't called Way of Ways of Making You Eat, this podcast.
That would be a good one, though.
I mean, I think food podcasts are a big thing. James, you wanted to talk about this. So that's what we're going to do, which is the Battle of San Pietro.
Well, yeah. And that whole operation in December 1943 for Fifth Army. Which actually includes Operation, you know, the appropriate named Operation Raincoat, which is the second battle of Capena. And, you know, it's really very overwhelming to be there, to be on the top of Monte Camino or to be on the top of Monte Samucro. And you realize that these two giant sentinels that are overlooking the Mignano Gap. And this is the strongest part of the Bernhard Line. And for those who don't know, or those who've forgotten, and we mentioned it in previous episodes, it's kind of like a double lock system here. And the reason this is so particularly strong is basically because the mountains go from one side to the other of the leg of Italy. So it's a very obvious natural strong point. And there is just this one big route through, which is the Mignano Gap. And then at the foot of the Monte Cassino Massive, about 10 miles, 8 miles further on, at Cassino, where the Via Casilina, the main ancient Roman highway that links Naples to Rome, it hugs the kind of the coast, the edge of the mountains at Cassino on the kind of northeastern side, and then disappears up north through the Liri Valley. And so it's this double lock, because the first bit that the Allies have got to get through is the Bernhard Line, the Winter Line, and then the second one is the Gustav Line. And these two lines are at their strongest at these two points. First the Mignano Gap and then a Cassino. And Cassino is still to come. But in December 1943, the United States Fifth Army, which also includes French troops by this point and several divisions of British troops as well, are desperately trying to get through this unspeakably strong defensive position. And it's a horror.
Why not stop? At this point, why not? You accept things as they are. The conditions are so bad, aren't they, for fighting? Why not? Why not wait till? Give yourselves a month off. Why not? Or wait till the spring? Or why? What's the imperative to carry on fighting in what is the opposite of the campaigning season? Because this isn't when you fight. The terrain does not favour the attacker. The Allies are also. You know, a lot of their battalions have been in the line a long time. They're all exhausted and they're running out of people and stuff's going to Northwest Europe or in anticipation of an offensive in Northwest Europe. Why carry on? Why not go, all right, we'll hold here. We're tying up enough Germans as it is. But let's shell them for a couple of months and not carry on pushing. What's the imperative to keep going?
The main one really is the buffer north of the Foggia airfields. So the Foggia airfields have been captured on the 27th of September, an age away by December 1943. And it is considered by General Alexander, who is the Army Group Commander, and absolutely rubber-stamped by Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean, up until the end of December 1943, and indeed the Chiefs of Staff, that what is needed is at least 50 miles north of Rome to be safe, because so much is being invested in Foggia. Originally, it was going to be six bomb groups, each of three, you know, each bomb group is three squadrons of, you know, 20 odd bombers with all the stuff that goes with it. You know, the ground crew, the fuel, the maintenance, the tents, the, you know, the whole shebang. That's been increased to 21 by March 1944. And this is a key component of Operation Overlord. This idea that you have to have complete control of airspace over the whole swathe of Northwest Europe before you can even think about crossing the channel. And it is seen that just operating out of bases from the UK to destroy the Luftwaffe, or certainly to push the Luftwaffe back far enough that they're not going to be a problem in Northwest Europe and a problem in Overlord, operating out of bases from the UK is not enough. And that a key part of this closing of the noose around the German aircraft industry, particularly, and that means, you know, destroying, hitting factories and all the rest of it, is getting into Foggia and operating out of Foggia. Certainly by the, you know, very heavily by the spring of 1944, which is why they're saying 21 bomb groups by March 1944, which is a huge commitment. And obviously you don't want to be doing, investing all this time, all this effort, all this commitment in these airfields around Foggia, which lies about two-thirds of the way up the leg on the Adriatic side, not on the western side where the Fifth Army are, if you're then going to lose it again. And, you know, there are huge numbers of German troops in Italy. There's more divisions than there are Allied divisions. The reason they're not all down at the front is because of German paranoia about being outflanked. But that's neither here nor there. You know, if you're the Allies, this is a very kind of high-risk situation. And so you've got to keep pushing away.
But defending in this part of the world is a straightforward business, is it not? I mean, this is the thing. Oh, John, this is ideal defensible country, isn't it? You only have to look
at it. It's perfect defensible country. I mean, it's made for that. Plus, the coast of Italy from coast to coast isn't that far. So they don't have to use up that much manpower either. You know, I also think in terms of why you keep pushing for the Allies, there's the sort of political symbolism and allure of Rome. That maybe that's why we're on the Italian peninsula at all.
Well, that's certainly why Churchill thinks so.
Exactly. And it's like almost like the mindset seems to me is almost like, well, we can't be there without getting Rome. We have to get Rome. And of course, then that means you have to keep pushing and to keep that pressure on the Germans, too, you know, to keep eating up their manpower.
And time is running out. There is this, you know, they've always said we're going to be in Rome by Christmas. And, they went into Italy on this promise that this assumption that the Germans were going to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line, which is about 200 miles north of Rome. So it was going to be this incredibly easy victory and everyone's a winner. But as we know, the Germans sort of changed their, you know, Hitler changed his mind, decided to kind of fight for every yard. And so there is this compunction for the Germans to fight south of Rome, even when clearly it's, you know, they've lost Foggia, so therefore there's no kind of massive point to it. But the Allies are also committed to getting on with it because the clock is ticking and they know they've got to get through, and Overlord is, you know, getting ever closer with every passing minute, and we've got to get there so that we can have these, our bombers can operate out of Foggia, and we need that up and running by spring, and, you know, that means we need our cushion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there is this huge pressure on it, and everything that everyone, those who the naysayers feared about Italy has come to pass, because, of course, it is sucking up more men and material.
The thing is, Jim, the point you make very clearly in Savage Storm is that, you know, for want of a better way of putting this is the third world road network that can't cope with, you know, the 3,000 vehicles that go with each infantry division, for instance. So would there even have been room for more? Do you have an option on more armies in Italy? Would that work anyway? It is actually, in the rough way that things have mussed themselves out, this is actually the best way to do this whole theater.
Yes, there is room in Italy because, you know, in May 1944, you have two armies literally alongside each other, the 5th and the 8th, and the 5th Army is massively swollen by that stage, you know, with the full whack of the French Expeditionary Corps, etc., and a whole enlarged corps waiting for them at Anzio. So, yes, there is. The point is, there isn't in winter when it's really, the days are short, the weather's appalling, it's pouring with rain, the rivers are flooded, you know, all the bridges have been blown up. But there was in September. That's the point. And the whole point about the Italian campaign is this is supposed to be a short, sharp, boom, get in, smash it, get Italy out of war, get Foggia, get to Rome, bish, bash, bosh, all done by kind of, you know, October the 10th. Had they landed with more landing craft, I don't think it's too fanciful to suggest that, say, Fifth Army had landed with six divisions rather than three, plus the special forces, plus a bit more kind of, you know, warships and all the rest of it. 16th Panzer would have had no chance of holding them for a minute. The counterattack would have completely failed before it had even got started because they'd have just swarmed straight through. The reason, you know, Salerno is such a tight fight. And then also that means you could have then also landed more divisions straight in to Taranto and Bari and Brindisi, and you could have completely overwhelmed whatever German defense, you know, before they had a chance to kind of see what was happening. And the whole thing, you know, you absolutely do get to Rome by, you know, second week of October or something. And then you can, once you get north of Rome, then you can have another think once the weather kicks in, you know. But it is fundamentally underestimating the strength of the enemy to start off with, not preparing enough to start off with, and under-resourcing what is an incredibly ambitious operation, and I'm talking about Operation Avalanche here, which is the Salerno landings, to land with three divisions only on such a major operation in that terrain with the hills absolutely surrounded by German observers. It's just not enough. And the warships they've got, you know, talking about warships, they've got like 71 warships compared to 250 for Husky. I mean, it is just not enough. And it's based on a wing and a prayer that the Italians are going to come in on their side. You know, I mean, how could you ever make a plan depending on the Italians at this point?
Yeah, especially after Giant 2 and that, you know, that whole
totally
fiasco,
right,
about dropping the 82nd Airborne Division there, which was absurd.
It's bonkers. And the whole presumption that the Germans are going to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line, which indeed they are right up to the moment of invasion, but that is the case. But the basis, the intelligence basis that the Allies have for this is based on one piece of evidence back in May 1943, a decrypted Enigma bit of traffic. And the second bit is the say-so of the Italians, who's saying during the armistice negotiations, when the Allies go, and is it still the German plan to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line? They go, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, I mean, they would say that, wouldn't they?
So breezy, I know.
It's so breezy. And consequently, they've gone down this course. They, you know, Mark Clark and his Fifth Army have actually pulled off quite an achievement in winning the day at Salerno, I would say. You know, because they've got the weight of six and a bit divisions coming towards them. They don't have anything like that amount. And they're seeing it off. Okay, they're seeing it off with the help of colossal firepower from the strategic air forces, the tactical air forces, but also increased warships. But even so, it's still a big thing, and Fifth Army and everyone who's involved in that should be extremely proud of what they do, because you know it is 100% total commitment. Every single battalion thrown into the line, you know, cooks and, you know, clerks and manning lines with rifles and all the rest of it. I mean, it really is that desperate, and yet they pull it off. And because Kesselring has thrown all his eggs in one basket, Kesselring being the overall German commander in the south of Italy at this point, because he's thrown all his eggs into one basket, he's left the back door open. And the back door is Taranto and Bari and Brindisi, where there is almost no troops whatsoever. And the only troops there are the troops which are least suited to being there, which are the Fallschirmjäger, who are the paratroopers, who are very heavily armed in small arms, but very poorly armed, because they're paratroopers, in heavy equipment. So all they can do in defense to the British landing in Taranto and subsequent landings around the other side of the coast, on the Adriatic coast, is rear guards and mining operations and all the rest of it. So this action at Salerno has caught Hitler's eye. And so suddenly Kesselring is the buona, not Rommel with his plans to retreat to the north. Rommel is kicked off to Normandy, and suddenly Kesselring finds himself in charge of the whole thing. And because he's this sort of relentless optimist, you know, which is not a particularly useful attribute to have, to be honest. You want to be a realist. You know, you don't want to be defeatist, but you don't want to be over-optimistic either. That's no good. Suddenly Hitler's watching him, and the Hitlerian spotlight's on him, and his room for maneuver is zero, because Hitler's now saying you've got to defend every single yard. So he's just chucking good after bad. I mean, you're seeing vast numbers of German troops absolutely destroyed, completely annihilated in this awful clash.
Is this how the Allies are reading it? Are they seeing it as Kesselring sort of feeding themselves into the mincer? Or are they thinking, to what extent do they know that decision-making by the Germans is this chaotic? Or are they thinking...
No, I don't think they do.
Right.
They don't have a good sense of that at all, I don't think. name.
I think they're thinking this is determined, and you know, every time you say a determined and skillful defense, but right. I don't think it is particularly skillful. I would really question that, because you know, how hard is it to kind of sit in a behind a rock in a mountain with a machine gun and keep firing? I mean, or set a mortar. I mean,
but we always assume that these are crack troops and these are defenses they've been working on for years. And it's the same thing with Normandy too. Like, you know, they've been working on this for years and years. Well, no, they've been working on it for weeks and weeks.
It's always that thing. They know the country. So they think, well, it's a mountain with one road up it. Right. I mean, I can work.
How
that
hard can
out.
It be to defend it? I mean, it's exactly. Just, it's really not. I mean, and there's this very, very interesting work by a German academic called Magnus Pahl, who really questions the skillful defense of the Fallschirmjäger of Cassino. I mean, he's just saying, you know, they put on a pedestal they don't deserve. You know, they're all German, so they're not Ostbritannians. So that gives them kind of, you know, slightly better morale and
motivation.
Incentive and all the motivation and stuff. But to say that they're all highly skilled and highly trained is just nonsense. And
well, they're good enough. They're willing to fight, which is all they have to be in that kind of terrain. They're willing to stand and fight, they can do a hell of a lot of damage. And that's the problem with the, you know, fighting in Italy in the first place, is that you don't necessarily have to be facing an enemy that is all that high speed. They can inflict massive damage on you just by controlling the kind of terrain they do and controlling something of the firepower that they have.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, von Senger, who is the commander of the 14th Panzer Corps, which is holding this section of the front, from when does he take over? Kind of late October, I think, if I remember rightly, 1943. You know, he is repeatedly saying we need to pull back to the Gustav line. I mean, we need to abandon the Bernhard line. This is absolutely ridiculous, because you know they're getting 80% casualties in their frontline troops. I mean, you know, I mean,
incredible.
But by today's standards, you would say any unit that has suffered 30% casualties can no longer function. Would you not, John? I mean, you know more about absolutely. Modern combat than I do.
It's combat ineffective, almost certainly.
Combat ineffective at 30% losses.
Easily.
These guys are suffering 80% losses. You know, you've got ludicrous scenarios where you've got, you know, it is generally considered by von Senger and by others that the 3rd Panzer Grenadier Division and the 15th Panzer Grenadier are better than others, because they've been around longer and they've been in theatre longer, and there's always a cadre of people who know what they're about and are, you know, experienced in this terrain. And they're kind of totally abused. And what you also find is you find penny packets being used. I mean, you know, one of the great mantras of the Blitzkrieg era is concentration of force, the Schwerpunkt. You know, this is the kind of the idea of the fist. You know, hit hard with the fist, not what is it? What's that Guderian quote? I always forget it. Knock and nicht Blixen or whatever it is.
Klotzen nicht Klaven or something like that, isn't it?
Something like that. Whatever it is. Anyway,
Cliff Klaven? What?
Klotzen anyway, or something. I can't remember. Not Klotzen nicht Klaken. I can't remember.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, basically hit hard, not softly is basically the point, and this is the whole point of the Schwerpunkt. And what you're finding is that, you know, the 3rd Panzer Grenadier is just being, you know, some of the units are on Monte Camino, some are up on Monte Maiala, some are on kind of, you know, on Monte Samucro. They're all over the place. I mean, it's just an absolute disaster. And morale is appalling. I mean, absolutely appalling. And they're being absolutely hammered.
It's similar to what's going on in Russia. I mean, it's always the same argument there. Don't give an inch. You know, units destroyed, caught in pockets. You know, that. I mean, that's already happening on the Russian front too. So this is the same thing now, just playing out in Italy. It's this the Hitlerian kind of defend every inch of ground approach. And you know, I mean, you're seeing it play out the same way. You know, just in this particular terrain, which happens to be more advantageous than a lot of what they're dealing with in Russia.
Yeah.
Same mindset.
But the fundamentals of it are that a modern army needs these arteries of railways and roadways, and the Via Casilina is the main road. There's 4 routes across that go northwards up Italy, but this is the number one route north from Naples to Rome, the Via Casilina, the Highway 6. And you need that road. You know, because obviously you need to go through the valleys, because trucks and lorries and tanks and artillery pieces can't climb up mountains. You know, that's just impossible. But on top of the mountains overlooking the roads are German observers with their fantastic optics. And they are surrounded by infantry protecting those observers. I mean, this is in its absolute basic kind of form. And the observers are directing artillery fire onto those arteries, onto the Via Casilina. So that you simply, if you're the American Fifth Army, you cannot go north through the up the Via Casilina until you have cleared the peaks on which these observers are viewing your every move in the valley below. And the only way you can clear these peaks of those observers is to send infantry up there with pack mules and supplies and prize out every single one, plus the infantry that are there to protect them. And that means this insane battles in the middle of the winter, which culminates in December 1943 with the Second Battle of Camino on one side, which is largely the British plus the Special Service Force, which is a mixed American Canadian force, on the southern side, and the 36th Texan Division on the northern side. And as everyone knows, the three most difficult things for an infantry unit to do are, one, an opposed beach landing, two, cross rivers, three, take mountain peaks. And the poor old Texans have just got to do it over and over again.
They are such a bad luck unit. I mean, they start off with Salerno. They deal with this nightmare. They deal with the Rapido. They end up in the Vosges. I mean, just such a hard luck unit. I think the only one I'd compare them to is the 28th Infantry Division, Pennsylvania National Guard, which has a wonderful moment in Paris, but really ends up in some of the worst meat grinders of the war, like at Hurtgen. They take the brunt of the German offensive in the Battle of the Bulge and the Bastogne Corridor, and later they fight in the Colmar Pocket. You know, so here's the 36th having survived Salerno. Now they got to deal with this nightmare that we generally call the Battle of San Pietro, but as Jim really, I think, remarkably, you know, and eloquently covers in his book Savage Storm, it's really about the struggle for these ridge lines that lead to the town on many levels, right? I mean, that's the key terrain that you have to have. And you end up with the commitment of the whole division. There isn't even a reserve regiment as this thing plays out.
Absolutely. And on the flanks of these peaks, you've got other peaks. So for example, Monte Corno is one of these peaks, and it looks over Venafro, the town of Venafro, which is a sort of base camp for 5th Army's operations, frankly, on the Bernhard Line. The Rangers, the U.S. Army Rangers, Darby's Rangers, are on top of Monte Corno for 45 days, which is longer than the entire Sicilian campaign.
Incredible.
I mean,
yeah. And that's a Ranger battalion that's not supposed to fight that way.
Oh, they're doing all sorts of things. Like they're trying to kind of annoy the Germans by putting kind of, you know, loudspeakers onto known mines, and they creep out in the middle of the night, put a speaker out, set the radio going. It's on a mine, they blow up, you know. I mean, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just bonkers. And so you have this really, really brutal battle for San Pietro, which is the village which is on the kind of lower slopes of Monte Simucrans. Monte Simucrans is this huge 3,000-foot high peak, you know, either side of the Mignano Gap. And San Pietro is the symbol of this battle, I think, really, this wider valley, this wider battle, which includes Camino, which includes kind of Monte Lungo, which is this long saddle in the middle of the valley floor, Monte Rotondo. You know, this is where Audie Murphy is, and the 3rd Division before their move back in place and replaced by the 36th Texans. And, you know, it's San Pietro is this once beautiful village. I mean, you know, when you're thinking about Italian villages with little winding cobbled streets and all the rest of it in a kind of pre-motorized age, everyone knows everyone. There's the church at the heart of it, which is substantially the biggest building there, where the municipio, the kind of town municipal building, the town hall, that was there, and it's using stones there which date back to Roman times. In fact, actually, you can still see in the ruins of San Pietro, you can see a little kind of a stone seat, I suppose it is. And on the top of the seat, you can see carved into the stone an ancient Roman board game on the stone. So this is a village that has been lived in forever, you know, for millennia. And the rhythms of its daily life have continued, you know, untroubled for centuries. You know, these are peasant farmers, contadini, as we would call them, which are basically sharecroppers. So you kind of, you know, half of what you give to a padrone, a kind of overlord, and there's an agent who comes around and collects it every year. Then there's a few other people who've kind of escaped the contadini system. But this is basically that how it works. And it's been like this for decades, for centuries, unchanged, really, very, you know, kept away from the rest of the kind of the kind of modern world. You know, fascism touches this only very, very lightly, a place like this. And this is the place of Wilhelm Maus, who was the chief medical doctor for the 14th Panzer Corps. Back in October, it was saying, you know, I can see this village and the hills, and it all looks very beautiful, and the sun's shining down, and, you know, I'm amidst the almond groves and the olives and the kind of vineyards, and it all looks so beautiful, this sort of haven. And he says, but I know that war is about to come here and tear this place to shreds. But you know, nature, and he's absolutely bang on, you know.
And because they had, a lot of the villagers had been evacuated, you know, before the heaviest fighting begins. And of course, you'd have this undercurrent of the coercion of the German presence, taking the young men to work them as laborers or do whatever. So some of them had fled. Families were trying to hide them. Families were hiding out in caves, like the cave terrain that some of which is there. So even before the actual American attack, the village has been denuded a lot out of its population. So they've been affected that way. And there's a couple things, too, that really strike me about this battle. The Italian experience, certainly on the civilian side, but also this first motorized group that becomes the first Italian soldiers to be fighting, you know, for their own soil. And I think we tend to overlook that. But also, too, this really strikes me as an historian of the U.S. Army, especially in this era. We actually embrace the idea of a night attack, which happens nowhere near enough for the U.S. armed forces in the course of this war. We tend to fight a dawn to dusk kind of combat. You know, we embrace that kind of combat rhythm. At San Pietro, it's completely different. So you have this social situation playing out. You've got the Italian military presence, and then you've got this difference in the American attack. I think it's really interesting.
We need to take a quick break right now. We'll see you in a moment.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Why are the Americans not keen on night attacks? Because after all, it's one of the things that in the British historiography, they like to pride themselves on the fact that the British do attack at night. The Germans are very bad at fighting at night. And that's always an impression you always get from the literature. Why are the Americans not nocturnal? What's going on?
I think there's a sense that it's really hard to coordinate troops and their movement at night, to coordinate vehicles, and especially your supporting firepower, your artillery observation, your airstrikes. There's a sense that we're really most potent in the daylight hours because that's where we can really employ our firepower at its maximum effect. And once we have it at night, we can do it defensively, but maybe not offensively. And I think it's a bit of a cop-out. But remember, this is before the night vision era or whatever. But it's one of the things I really do often criticize about the American Armed Forces is I think, just in a very general sense, we kind of cede the night to our enemies through the Vietnam era, almost, the pre-night vision era. It changes radically after that. But it's almost like, okay, well, it's nightfall now, so let's hunker down in a perimeter, and we'll just shoot at anything that moves out there. Now, in the European theater, you've got, you know, recon patrols and combat patrols going out at night and all that kind of stuff, too. But I'm talking about major attacks, like at San Pietro, where they're actually going to move at night. And I think the thinking there, you know, I don't know, Jim, what your impression was, but it's always been my view that their impression is that's the way you could do this kind of coup de main to take this sort of tough high ground that in the daylight, the Germans are looking right down your throat.
Yeah, so, they'll see you.
So it's almost out of desperation, don't you think? It's like, so it's almost out of desperation that we embrace this idea of a night attack. And I wish it would have been applied other places.
Well, it sort of fits into the pictures of those Rangers trying stuff because they're basically stuck. So you start thinking, you have to start thinking outside your usual way of doing things to try and find a solution. It's sort of as simple as that, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the fighting on Monte Simuco that the British have been doing has been at night. So the Ox and Bucks are on Camino at the start of December, helping the guards, and that's all at night. All of that is going on at night. Absolutely everything they're doing, attempts to get the Germans off the top of the hill. It's all night fighting. It's all horrendous and disorganized and organized within the parameters of how difficult fighting at night is. Trying to do set piece attacks, being caught up in a state of constant change of improvisation, no one really knowing where they are, no one really knowing what's going on, all that sort of thing. And it not working. So even attacking at night's no guarantee of success in this situation.
So the other thing is the topography of the mountains. So in the case of Samukro, there's a kind of sort of the southwest facing towards the sea, effectively, because there's a temptation to think that sort of, you know, Italy just goes northwards, but actually it's the leg of Italy is at an angle, which is sort of roughly in a kind of sort of northwesterly direction if you're looking northwards. So the southwest-facing side of Samukro is pretty steep, and at the top it's really steep. You can't attack up it. You just can't. I mean, you can crawl up it two-handed, just about. From the German side, from the kind of northern side of it, it's a climb, but it's a comparatively gentle climb. I mean, you can walk on it. You can climb up to the summit on your own 2 feet from the German side. And today, if you were going to climb up Samukro, that is the route you would take. You would take the German approach, and that is definitely the easiest way. So again, that favors the defender massively. The only alternative route to get to the summit from the American point of view is from the southeast, and that follows two ridges. And the ridges are unspeakably challenging. They're narrow ridges, which canalizes you, and they're pretty steep. And as you get near the summit of Samukro, it's pretty hardcore. I mean, you are having to kind of occasionally use your hands to haul yourself up and all this kind of stuff. And it's unthinkable that you could do this in daylight. I mean, you know, because everyone will see you. You can cover it in smoke, but you just, it's unthinkable. The only chance you have to do it is to use the night and to use shadows and rocks and to kind of scamper up there. And the amazing thing is that they do take the peak of Samukro on, I think it's the 9th of December, which is basically the same time that the Germans decide to bug out of Camino. And they're on the peak, but then immediately from the peak, it drops down and then rises up again to these three knolls, these little high points. So you might be on the top of Samukro, but you can't, and you can, from there, you can direct artillery fire. Yes, you absolutely can, but you've still got to actually physically get men down from the summit and then climb up again to these three hillocks, you know, these sort of stony outcrops, these high points, which are not as high as the Samukro summit, but still involve going down then up again to reach them, if you see what I mean.
And that's the war in Italy. There's always another summit.
And I cannot begin to tell you, when you're at the top of Samukro, the thing that strikes you is there is no soil. I mean, there is soil, but there's
no place to dig in.
Everywhere you go is just lots and lots of pebbles and stones and small stones and big stones, all of which have obviously been smashed up by artillery back in 1943, which has made the situation worse. And obviously, this exaggerates the effect of every mortar and every grenade and every artillery round that's coming down, because the shell's got nowhere to go, so it just goes out and takes with it lots of shards of razor-sharp bits of limestone rock. And so the lethality of the shelling is substantially greater than it was. And, of course, the problem that they finally have, they've got this, Walker comes up. Fred Walker is the Major General commanding of the 36th Texans. And he comes up with this unspeakably complicated plan for the final crushing of this position on the northern side, which involves an attack with tanks down the only kind of high low road, if you see what I mean. It's above the valley floor, but it is parallel to the mountain. So it's got a kind of, it's got a sharp side to the north, like any mountain road that's running down the side of a mountain. It's got a drop on the left-hand side, and it's got a steep climb on a wall on the right-hand side. So there's no room for maneuver whatsoever. So these tanks can only go in line astern, one after the other. And there's 17 and of them, I think. Price. 16 Shermans 16, and one yeah. Valentine. And so that is one plan, which is going to be launched on the morning of the 15th of December, if I remember rightly, followed by a coordinated attack that night from the summit to take these three peaks below the summit in a night operation. And then the following morning, they're all going to come together in San Pietro and clear off the whole mountain for the following morning. And there is also another operation to kind of sort of clear the rest of Monte Lungo and blah, blah, blah. And there is just not a gnat's chance of this all coming together, because there's too many moving parts, there's too many levers. It's a really, really bad plan. And that is Walker's plan. I mean, there's no one else's plan.
You know what's ironic about all this? We're there for air power, in a way. The heavy bombers and all that, like you said, Jim, improving upon Foggia, sending in more resources than you ever expect, and all of which is supposed to negate this very kind of warfare. But actually, how are we fighting now? We're fighting almost with rocks, man to man, infantry to infantry, deep in these ridges and hills at night. It couldn't be more elemental, could it? And when we try and send in some of the more modern ground vehicles and weapons, these tanks, it's more or less a disaster. So how can this be done? Like you said, infantry with mules up there fighting on these peaks, and that's the war. I mean, all these things were not supposed to happen, were they? I mean, it was supposed to be the end of this kind of ground fighting. And in fact, this search for air power has led to exactly this kind of struggle of ground power in that sense.
But the interesting thing is the Allied chiefs of staff and the big chiefs in Italy have only got, all of whom were in theater in North Africa the previous winter, have only got a look at Tunisia, which was all supposed to be over by Christmas.
Right.
And wasn't. And why wasn't it? Because it was wet and miserable and cold, and the mud got in the way, and there was 10 tents cloud, and Allied air forces couldn't operate in the way that they wanted to, and they hadn't quite got themselves organized as well. But here you are again. And it just goes to prove that the old campaigning series of season of sort of in the days of yore are still as valid in this kind of hyper mechanized ultra modern war of the 1940s as they were back in kind of 1600s.
They really are. And we're always so fixated on ending things before Christmas. I mean, that's just so mystifying to me, because it's the same thing the next year, when, the Germans are going to collapse after Normandy and we'll all be home by Christmas. Well, even if the war ends, you're not going to be home by Christmas. I hate to tell you, dude. I mean, it's not going to happen. We're going to need you for occupation and whatever else. I mean, it's just mystifying to me. You saw the same thing, like you said, in Tunisia. We see the same thing then, the next year in Italy. We're going to be at Rome by Christmas or whatever. But, it strikes me there's two things about this horrible fight at San Pietro that we should probably address that are best remembered about it. The death of Captain Henry Wasco, which becomes, of course, Ernie Pyle's probably most famous column, wouldn't we all say? And then, and of course, the John Huston film called San Pietro, or Battle of San Pietro, or whatever, which is ostensibly showing the battle, but as we all know, not really. I mean, those are really interesting base points here. I mean, Wasco is killed in the context of these very operations we're talking about.
Well, he is killed on that night, the night of the 15th, 16th, which is the night battle that follows the kind of the fight earlier that day to try and get into San Pietro from the lower slopes. What they have to do that night, and I think it's the 42nd, if I remember rightly. Is it the second battalion of the 142nd?
I think it's second battalion. Yeah. Maybe E Company, but I could be wrong.
Something like that. But what I do know is that out of that battalion, by the following morning, only 155 men are still standing.
Yeah.
You know, out of a battalion of 850 or whatever it is. And this is also symptomatic of the supply situation in Italy, that these battalions are operating constantly at understrength. They're never full strength, which is a situation which is sort of rarely tolerated in Normandy, for example, in 6 months further down the line. Captain Wasco is killed leading his company.
He's B Company 143rd.
143rd, that's right.
Yeah.
And the first battalion, so it's the second battalion. And, you know, there's quite a good moon that night. It's a clear night. And it's so obvious. I remember standing on one of these three knolls that they've got to try and capture, looking back up towards the peak of Samucro, and you can totally see why so many Texans, so many of these divisions, these Americans of this division, this battalion, are getting cut down. Because behind your rock on this knoll, you are totally hidden. Totally, totally hidden. The moment anyone gets up from the peak, you're silhouetted against the sky, this moonlit sky. You simply cannot move.
You know, you described really well the fragmentation effect earlier of all the rocks and whatnot up there. Well, it's fragments that basically kill him, that take a big chunk out of his chest. And again, that's kind of a microcosm, isn't it? That, like you said, you're silhouetted up there. All the Germans have to do is throw in some mortar rounds or call in some artillery. Doesn't take great skill, you know, to your earlier point. It just takes basic soldiering. And you can inflict massive losses, of which Wasco becomes kind of the face of this horrible operation that really, you know, probably eats up about a third of the division's combat power, I would say, roughly, you know.
Absolutely. And the amazing thing is, from the top of Samucro, you can see the foot of the mule trail. I mean, it can only be that one, because there's basically only two routes up. There's no alternative. And they know that. And the other thing that's amazing about it is, and I've sort of mentioned this to you before, but you don't need a metal detector to find shrapnel up there. I mean, you just wander around. I mean, literally just walk up there, and it's everyone. When we went up there last time in whenever it was, April, everyone found some. I mean, everyone found some just by kind of half looking at the ground as you're kind of wandering up. I mean, it's everywhere. And the other thing is, there's still remains of German Sangers and stuff, and they're really strong positions. I mean, you know, because you're completely hidden behind these rocks. Behind these little hollows, you know, they're sort of scrapes in the ground surrounded by rocks. I mean, we've all seen the things before. I mean, you know the look. And from a defender's point of view, these are just very strong. And what does for them, ultimately, is that the Germans just lose more men than the Americans do. And there are enough of them defending the mountain by this stage because the attrition rate has been so great. And the German replacements are even, you know, poorer than the Americans are. And they just can't hold it any longer. There's just not enough manpower to do it. But what holds them up for such a long time is the Americans up for such a long time is because comparatively few defenders with mortars and machine guns can cause a hell of a lot of damage.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, very, very difficult place. I mean, it is insane that they're fighting up there. I mean, really, but what's the alternative? There is no alternative to doing
that. And that's why they're fighting up there, because there's no other alternative if we're to have this mission. Well, and it also speaks to, I think, a larger point of why do the Allies succeed? Because they have enough persistence. They have enough resolve to continue fighting. They have enough people who are willing to do this. And again, here, let's just look at what happens with the Italian First Motorized Group that goes up there for all of one night or something, and not necessarily to disparage them, but they take terrible losses, and they're like, okay, I'm sorry, we couldn't do the mission, we're done. They have a very rational viewpoint in that sense, but that usually isn't the Anglo-American viewpoint. It's, okay, we've just gotten our nose terribly bloodied. Let's figure out another way to keep doing this, but we will keep doing it, and we will keep attacking until we take it. And I think that's a lot of times what gets lost in this sort of Allied inevitability kind of interpretation of World War II, that they're going to win no matter what, is the real details of what this was like. And that if I'm in the 36th Division, it's you know what? What can you do to me worse than sending me up there? Military discipline? Are you kidding me? So something has to propel me to keep going up there and fighting, whatever it is. Maybe it's great leadership like Wasco. That could be. Maybe it's not. You know, I don't know. But whatever it is, we find enough people to continue to do this. And I think this is a classic example because San Pietro is a horrible battle.
Oh, well, I was going to ask, because one of the things that's striking about this battle is, you know, for instance, Pyle's journalism, which is, you know, I mean, it's very moving to read. And it makes it sort of unequivocal that the war is about loss. It is about death. It is about the senselessness of death and all that. And then there's John Huston's film as well, which we mentioned earlier. So the public in America are not getting a varnished version of this. I think it's very interesting that the American way of doing things at this time, and, you know, we watched the Tarawa footage as well, which obviously had to be, you know, cleared by FDR because it had American dead in it, all that sort of stuff. The American approach seems to be to say, and given there's a American opinion only 5 minutes previously has been very largely in favor of not getting involved, and Europe's none of America's business politically and all this sort of stuff. I think it's really interesting that the way of telling the story of the war for public consumption at home is with this very frank stuff. Where's that coming from? What's the sort of reasoning behind that? And who's making those decisions?
Oh, I think, certainly the Roosevelt administration, the Office of War Information, in tandem with the military service chiefs like General George Marshall in the case of the Battle of San Pietro film. And I think where this comes from is that for the average American, this war can be a very detached thing. It's, I have a war-related job now, and I've got great employment, and I'm making money, or I'm living in a different place. It's all very exciting. You know, I'm a young person working in Washington, D.C. now. I'm an African-American leaving the Deep South for opportunities on the West Coast or, you know, whatever. There could be a temptation. This is all very distant, and I think it's a reminder that the government wants for some, at the right time and place, sort of spoon-feeding the public, hey, look, this is what the war really is. And this is why you don't slack off in your, you know, factory job or whatever it is you're doing. And this is why you need to keep supporting, because for the guys who are fighting it, this is the reality. I think there's a real schism there between those who are fighting the war and those who are home, particularly those who are in labor unions and think, yeah, we can strike. It's like normal times. We need a better contract or whatever. And, you know, it isn't normal times. There's people's lives on the line.
And they have the opportunity to bargain, after all, because a load of men have left the workplace.
Exactly, which puts a premium on labor.
I think Jim, the other day, you read Mark Clark's sort of peroration about how he feels about what needs to be done in Italy, and the, you know, an essentially morally righteously angry call to arms for Americans in the campaign in Italy. And again, I'm really struck by the sort of the tone that is saying this is what war is. We're not pretending or glossing over what war is. How was the First World War handled in this regard? Were people given an unvarnished version of things? Or is it an attempt to make sure that there isn't a kind of, as you said, John, a dislocation between the people fighting the war and the people supporting it at home or manufacturing stuff for it at home, whatever?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in World War One. It's kind of similar. It just doesn't go on as long for the U.S., I'm saying. It's the fall of 1918, really.
Right. So things don't get as sort of baked in as they do. Because this tone continues for the rest of the Second World War, doesn't it? That this is, this is a bad thing and your boys are dying. And which I think is really, really, really interesting because that feels, I don't know, often, I guess, lazy assumptions about what the 1940s were like and people's, you know, that we think of the, In fact, in a way that the modern media has offered us the Second World War, it's bugles and it's the greatest generation, all this sort of stuff.
They didn't look at it that way at the time.
No.
We look at it as we live in an era of social media and sophisticated, you know, information and communication, which we do, of course. But so did they in the 1940s. It was the most sophisticated nodes of communication in human history up to that time. It was an incredibly visual generation, especially in America. So the government is kind of walking this sort of tightrope of wanting to, you know, as I mentioned, impress upon the people at home what the war really is and why they need to be invested in it on a lot of levels. But they also don't want to crush morale. And so that's why you really have to think twice about showing the bodies at Tarawa or, you know, what Huston's film is going to look like. Because to me, what really stands out to me about the film long term is that they show You know, the dead Americans, they do show them being buried, and you kind of see some snippets of faces, and you get a little sense of what this looks like as they're burying people. And I know that the film is contrived on a lot of levels, and Houston tried to sell it as this is the actual combat footage and most of it isn't. Okay, but lay that aside. You are seeing the destruction. You are seeing what the weapons look like, you know, and the explosions, all that white phosphorus that you see, for instance. You know what I mean? And you're seeing the bodies and all that. And so to someone just watching in a theater in January 1945, whenever it is released, it's very powerful, I think, compared to our sort of cynical latter year, oh, we know how they really made the sausage kind of view.
Yeah.
This is really potent stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And of course, Houston was over there to film the liberation of Rome. I mean, that's why he'd been sent over there, and that's what he's supposed to do.
Yes, but
then got there, so he thought, well, I'll film this instead. And also, I think it's important to kind of, you know, to recognize that the village itself of San Pietro is completely destroyed, and lots of the locals are killed because lots of them are lots of the men are kind of forced into Organization Tote, which is the you know, the German labor force. Others are kind of driven out of their homes. Some of them go to the mountains. Then they start creating homes that they dig out homes in the soft tufa limestone, which is very soft. It's the same limestone they have in Malta that enables them to dig all these tunnels and stuff in Malta during the siege. Well, they do these caves in the kind of sort of western slopes of the edge of the village. There's a kind of sort of bit of a kind of cliff face down to this kind of gorge, and they dig in there and they're sitting there, and this tragedy occurs because once the battle gets closer, they can't get to the stream on the lower slopes anymore, and they're not starving, but they're running out of water, and there's children and stuff. And so one day, a whole load of them decide that they're going to they learn that there is a cistern at the southeastern edge of the village, which is still hasn't been turned brackish by the Germans putting kind of, you know, awful things in it, and it's still drinkable. So they decide in the course of the, you know, overnight, what they'll do is they'll creep out in the, you know, the cover of darkness and fill up their water pails and go get some water from the cistern. But it means going from one side of the village to the other. Now, normally that would take maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes walk at most. But of course, it's nighttime and Germans are about and Americans are about and there's mines and they don't know where they, you know, they're having to pick their way through the rubble of the village and, you know, they're trying not to make a noise. So what takes 10, 15 minutes takes hours to get there. And by the time they've got the water and they're coming back, the first sort of little lights of dawn are kind of creeping across the village. And the Americans at the southeastern side see these figures moving around in the main piazza just beneath the church and think they're Germans. Why would they think anything else? An open fire. And a whole load of them are killed. And one of the people that's killed is Rosa Fuoco, who is 32 years old. She's shot in the heart and just dies. And she lies on the piazza for 3 days or 2 days or whatever it is until the Americans finally liberated on the morning of the 17th of December. And there she is where she fell a few days before, killed by an American bullet, still clutching her pail of without water. And after the war, there was no chance that this could be lived in again. You know, the time had moved on as well, and having a village sort of halfway up a mountain or a quarter of the way up a mountain is no good. So they rebuilt the village on the lower slopes where it's closer to the Via Casilina and less cut off from the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just remained as it was. It's overgrown. You can visit there now and wander around the old roads and pathways. You can just about see the caves at the edge of the village where they sheltered during the battle. And you can see the cisterns that they were trying to get to and stuff. And it's profoundly moving because, of course, nature's taken its course and some of the buildings have collapsed and the roofs have caved in and ivy's growing up the walls and trees through the old living rooms and all this kind of stuff. But it's a kind of this sort of pathetic in the truest sense sort of symbol of this shattering of lives that was centuries old. I mean, you know, I've just been listening to Brother Tom's stuff on the Aztecs. You know, the Spanish turning up and just sort of turning everything that the Mexica knew and understood kind of on its head. And it's kind of the same thing happening here in a funny sort of way. You know, these lives are just centuries old and they've just been cut short and that's it. And there's no going back. It's changed forever by this tragedy of this battle taking place in this
in this valley, you know, that should never have been fought over. I mean,
it's hard to imagine anything in Hannibal's time that could have been as uprooting and as traumatic as this. Yet this represented liberation, ironically, I guess, you know, we'd all agree.
But what a hell
of a price to pay. And what Mussolini hath wrought, in a way, getting Italy involved in this war, and what a disaster it was for Italy on so many levels. And this is where you see it play out. My God, I mean, the price they paid.
Well, you can, civilian populations, when they're the meat and the sandwich, it's a thing that's happening right now all over the world in lots of different conflicts.
Not in any one place in particular
is the truth. Yeah. Merry Christmas, everyone, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. This makes you feel great, doesn't it?
But the thing for me, is, I mean, they all had a miserable time at Christmas, obviously. But they've got through this kind of final massive effort to get through the Bernhard Line, the Winter Line. They've finally got San Pietro. They've finally got Monte Camino. They're through to the other side. And now they're confronted by the Gustav Line. They've got to do it all over again.
Yeah, so we've got to do it all again.
It's like, you ain't seen nothing yet. Casino's waiting. I mean.
Oh, man. I mean, that's the thing it's so apparent in all the diaries that I'm reading for the beginning of 1944 at the moment, and all the testimonies. They're spent already. That's the point. You know, before you think about crossing the Rapido, before you think about kind of climbing up the Monte Cassino Massive, these guys are already absolutely had it up to here.
Which brings me back to my first question. Why not stop for a month? Why not?
Well, I agree.
You know, like in the Soviet style, where what you do is you build up to a great big hammer blow. I mean, and obviously that comes down to a slightly different approach to your manpower and how you feel about your soldiers, doesn't it?
Well, but again, because they're wanting these airfields up and running in their entirety by March to help with Overlord.
Yeah.
So it's the tyranny of Overlord is overshadowing everything that's happening in Italy. And there's still this pressure to get north of Rome so that you've got this buffer, so that you've got this cushion. And the hope is that if they can do an outflanking operation, which the topography of Italy lends itself to, then that will force the Germans to pull back from their current position because they don't want to have a force coming in around the back. But just like Avalanche, Operation Shingle, which is the Anzio landings, which are going to take place in the third week of January 1944, are not big enough in scale to guarantee success in any shape or form. And so yet again, they're confronted with the guys on the ground are confronted with exactly the same problem that they're confronted with when they're going in with Avalanche, the initial invasion of Italy at Salerno, that it's too little to guarantee to achieve what they want to achieve. So it's more of a kind of sort of, we're doing this with a kind of a wing and a prayer rather than with any kind of sense of guarantees. But because that landing has to be successful, a maximum effort is needed on the Gustav Line to ensure that the Germans are distracted when they land at Anzio. So Anzio is there to relieve the Gustav Line, but in order to be able to relieve the Gustav Line, you have to have maximum effort against the Gustav Line first. And so you've got this yet again renewed effort and huge pressure on Fifth Army to do something substantial, crossing the Garigliano and the Rapido, get up Monte Cassino, you know, on a broad front from Minterno on the sea all the way up to kind of north of Cassino in January 1944, when the weather is dreadful, there's snow on the mountains, it's raining again, and it's miserable and awful, and everyone's fed up and exhausted. And it's kind of a recipe for disaster.
And it's the pressures of global war, because there's only so many resources to go around. And the fact that they then redeploy landing craft for Operation Shingle affects Normandy, you know, pushing it back from May to June, famously. And certainly this has an effect on how the Battle of Normandy plays out. I mean, who knows, you know, and then not to mention what's going on in the Pacific. It's just another example of doing what's possible rather than what's ideal, I guess.
Yeah. And it's the nature of the fact that on the priority list of all the major operations that the Allies are doing at this time, Italy's at the bottom of the rung.
China's really at the bottom of the
list. China last on the list.
And because Chiang Kai-shek is in the process of getting completely screwed at this point, too, when the Americans in particular have promised him, you know, operations in Burma, amphibious operations, and you know, the British had acceded to this, and then of course post Tehran they all renege on that, and you know, yeah. because of Normandy and because of Anzio and all, here we go again. So Chiang Kai-shek usually gets the last bite at the apple, and then obviously Alexander and the Italian theater get the next last bite at the apple as things go on. And I mean, it's just such a mess, I guess.
But it's all driven by fundamentally kind of decent ideals, which is let's get this show over and done with as quickly as possible so that minimum amount of people get killed. But by trying to hurry it up, you're also kind of making it worse.
Well, and yeah, exactly. Haste makes waste. Yeah. I mean, and yeah, and also a very decent idea. Let's destroy this odious regime in Berlin as soon as we possibly can, you know, the Germany first strategy or whatever, which, I mean, this isn't what's driving it, but in the light of the Holocaust later, I certainly think we'd all agree there's a great moral imperative to that too. But that not isn't necessarily what's driving their grand strategy, of course, but certainly it's a factor.
But if you live in San Pietro, it's your misfortune that in order to destroy the government in Berlin, you've got to go through there. You've got to go through up and down these mountains and valleys and on and on and on. Well,
and San Pietro stands in for so many other places.
Exactly.
You know, as things unfold. Yep.
Exactly. Well, thanks very much, Jim. Thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this year of War Waffle with an American Tilt. There'll be more of it next year. We'll see you hopefully at We Have Ways Festival in July. Thanks for listening. Have a good one, John, and you, Jim. Cheerio.
Cheers, everyone, and you guys.
And to you. See ya.